The key point of this chapter is not just the idea of getting the right people on the team. The key point is that who questions come before what decisions, before vision, before strategy, before organization structure, before tactics. First who, then what, as a rigorous discipline consistently applied. The comparison companies frequently followed what we came to call the genius with a thousand helpers model. A genius leader who sets a vision and then enlists a crew of highly capable helpers to make the vision happen. This model fails when the genius departs. The good to great leaders were rigorous, not ruthless, in people decisions. They did not rely on layoffs and restructuring as a primary strategy for improving performance. The comparison companies used layoffs to a much greater extent. We uncovered three practical disciplines for being rigorous in people decisions. Discipline number one, when in doubt, don't hire, keep looking. Corollary to discipline one, a company should limit its growth based on its ability to attract enough of the right people. Discipline number two, when you know you need to make a people change, act. Corollary to discipline number two, first, be sure you don't simply have someone in the wrong seat. And discipline number three, put your best people on your biggest opportunities, not your biggest problems. Corollary to discipline number three, if you sell off your problems, don't sell off your best people. Good to great management teams consist of people who debate vigorously in search of the best answers, yet who unify behind decisions regardless of their personal parochial interests. And of course, we had some unexpected findings. First, we found no systematic pattern linking executive compensation to the shift from good to great. The purpose of compensation, we concluded, is not to motivate the right behaviors from the wrong people, but to get and keep the right people in the first place. The old adage, people are your most important asset, is wrong. People are not your most important asset. The right people are. And finally, whether someone is the right person has more to do with character traits and innate capabilities than with specific knowledge, background, or skills. It all adds up to an orientation, an obsession, a lens, a frame of reference for everything you do from this point forward. First who, then what. First who, then what. Chapter 4, Confront the Brutal Facts, Yet Never Lose Faith. There is no worse mistake in public leadership than to hold out false hopes soon to be swept away. Winston Churchill, The Hinge of Fate. In the early 1950s, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, commonly known as A&P, stood as the largest retailing organization in the world, and one of the largest corporations in the United States, at one point ranking behind only General Motors in annual sales. Kroger, in contrast, stood as an unspectacular grocery chain, less than half the size of A&P, with performance that barely kept pace with the general market. Then in the 1960s, A&P began to falter, while Kroger began to lay the foundations for a transition into a great company. From 1959 to 1973, both companies lagged behind the market, with Kroger pulling just a bit ahead of A&P. After that, the two companies completely diverged, and over the next 25 years, Kroger generated cumulative returns 10 times the market, and 80 times better than A&P. How on earth did such a dramatic reversal of fortunes happen? How could a company as great as A&P, the number two largest company in the United States, the largest retailing company in the world, become so awful. A&P had a perfect model for the first half of the 20th century, when two world wars and a depression imposed frugality upon Americans. Cheap, plentiful groceries sold in utilitarian stores. But in the affluent second half of the 20th century, Americans changed. They wanted nicer stores, bigger stores, more choices in stores. They wanted fresh baked bread, flours, health foods, cold medicines, fresh produce, 45 choices of cereal, and 10 types of milk. They wanted offbeat items like 5 different types of expensive sprouts and various concoctions of protein powders and Chinese healing herbs. Oh, and they wanted to be able to do their banking and get their annual flu shots while shopping. In short, they no longer wanted grocery stores. They wanted superstores with a big block S on the chest, offering almost everything under one roof, with lots of parking, cheap prices, clean floors, and a gazillion checkout lines. Right off the bat, you might be thinking, okay, so the story of A&P is one of an aging company that had a strategy that was right for the times. And then the times changed, and the world passed it by as younger, better-attuned companies gave customers more of what they wanted. What's so interesting about that? Same old story. Here's what's interesting. Both Kroger and A&P were old companies. Kroger at 82 years, A&P at 111 years, heading into the 1970s. Both Kroger and A&P had nearly all their assets invested in traditional grocery stores. Both companies had strongholds outside the major growth areas of the United States. And both companies had knowledge of how the world around them was changing. Yet, one of these two companies confronted the brutal facts of reality head on and completely changed its entire system in response. The other stuck its head in the sand. In 1958, Forbes magazine described A&P as the Hermit Kingdom, run as an absolute monarchy by an aging prince. Ralph Berger, the successor to the Hartford brothers, who had built the A&P dynasty, sought to preserve two things above all else: cash dividends for the family foundation and the past glory of the Hartford brothers. According to one A&P director, Berger considered himself the reincarnation of old John Hartford, even to the point of wearing a flower in his lapel every day from Hartford's greenhouse. He tried to carry out, against all opposition, what he thought Mr. John, that is, Mr. John Hartford, would have liked. Berger instilled a what-would-Mr.-Hartford-do approach to decisions, living by the motto, "You can't argue with 100 years of success." Indeed, through Berger, Mr. Hartford continued to be the dominant force on the board for nearly 20 years. Never mind the fact that he was already dead. As the brutal facts about the mismatch between its past model and the changing world began to pile up, A&P mounted an increasingly spirited defense against those facts. In one series of events, the company opened a new store called the Golden Key, a separate brand wherein it could experiment with new methods and models to learn what customers wanted. It sold no A&P branded products. It gave the store manager more freedom. It experimented with innovative new departments, and it began to evolve toward what would become the modern superstore. Customers really liked it. Here, right under their noses, they began to discover the answer to the question of why they were losing market share and what they could do about it. They had the solution in the palm of their own hands. And what did A&P executives do with the Golden Key? They didn't like the answers it gave, so they closed it. A&P then began a pattern of lurching from one strategy to another, always looking for a single-stroke solution to its problems. It held pep rallies, launched programs, grabbed fads, fired CEOs, hired CEOs, and fired them yet again. It launched what one industry observer called a scorched earth policy, a radical price-cutting strategy to build market share, but never dealt with the basic fact that customers wanted not lower prices, but different stores. The price cutting led to cost cutting, which led to even drabber stores and poorer service, which in turn drove customers away, further driving down margins, resulting in even dirtier stores and worse service. After a while, the crud kept mounting, said one former A&P manager. We not only had dirt, we had dirty dirt. Meanwhile, over at Kroger, a completely different pattern arose. Kroger also conducted experiments in the 1960s to test the superstore concept. By 1970, the Kroger executive team came to an inescapable conclusion. The old model grocery store, which accounted for nearly 100% of Kroger's business, was going to become extinct. Unlike A&P, however, Kroger confronted this brutal truth and acted on it. The rise of Kroger is remarkably simple and straightforward, almost maddeningly so. During their interviews, Lyle Everingham and his predecessor, Jim Herring, they were the CEOs during the pivotal transition years, were polite and helpful, but a bit exasperated by our questions. To them, it just seemed so clear. When we asked Everingham to allocate 100 points across the top five factors in the transition, he said, I find your question a bit perplexing. Basically, we did extensive research, and the data came back loud and clear. It's that simple. The super combination stores were the way of the future. We also learned that you had to be number one or number two in each market, or you had to exit. Sure, there was some skepticism at first, but once we looked at the facts, there was really no question about what we had to do. So we just did it. Kroger decided to eliminate, change, or replace every single store and depart every region that did not fit the new realities. The whole system would be turned inside out, store by store, block by block, city by city, state by state. By the early 1990s, Kroger had rebuilt its entire system on the new model and was well on the way to becoming the number one grocery chain in America, a position it would attain in 1999. Meanwhile, A&P still had over half its stores, in the old 1950 size and had dwindled to a sad remnant of a once great American institution. Facts are better than dreams. One of the dominant themes from our research is that breakthrough results come about by a series of good decisions, diligently executed and accumulated one on top of another. Of course, the good to great companies did not have a perfect track record. But on the whole, they made many more good decisions than bad ones. And they made many more good decisions than the comparison companies. More important, on the really big choices, such as Kroger's decision to throw all its resources into the task of converting its entire system to the superstore concept, they were remarkably on target. This, of course, begs a question. Are we merely studying a set of companies that just happened by luck to stumble into the right set of decisions? Or was there something distinctive about their process that dramatically increased the likelihood of being right? The answer, it turns out, is that there was something quite distinctive about their process. Even though they saw themselves as lucky, they were not just lucky. The good to great companies displayed two distinctive forms of disciplined thought. Now, let me just pause here for a moment and remind us of the framework that we laid out at the beginning of this audiobook. A good to great transformation proceeds in a process of build-up leading to breakthrough. And that build-up to breakthrough process breaks into a few basic stages. In particular, stage one, disciplined people. Stage two, disciplined thought. Stage three, disciplined action. Disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought, who take disciplined action. The previous two chapters, Level 5 Leadership and First Who, were about disciplined people. The next two chapters, the one we're in now and the hedgehog, are all about disciplined thought. That's where we are in the framework. The first key method of disciplined thought, and the topic of this chapter, is that the good to great companies infuse the entire process with the brutal facts of reality. The second, which we will discuss in the next chapter, is that they developed a simple yet deeply insightful frame of reference for all decisions. When, as in the Kroger case, you start with an honest and diligent effort to determine the truth of the situation, the right decisions often become self-evident. Not always, of course, but often. And even if all the decisions do not become self-evident, one thing is certain. You absolutely cannot make a series of good decisions without first confronting the brutal facts. The good to great companies operated in accordance with this principle, and the comparison companies generally did not. Consider Pitney Bowes versus Adressograph during the transition of the 1970s. It would be hard to find two companies in more similar positions at a specific moment in history that then diverged so dramatically. Until 1973, Pitney Bowes and Adressograph had similar revenues, profits, numbers of employees, and stock charts. Both companies held near monopoly market positions with virtually the same customer base. Pitney Bowes in postage meters and Adressograph in address duplicating machines. And both faced the imminent reality of losing their monopolies. By year 2000, however, Pitney Bowes had grown to over 30,000 employees and had revenues in excess of $4 billion, compared to the sorry remnants of Adressograph, which had less than $100 million in revenues and only 670 employees. For the shareholder, Pitney Bowes outperformed Adressograph 3,581 to 1. Yes, 3,581 times better. So here we have a classic match pair. We have two companies in 1973 that are virtually identical. They're in the same kind of situation with the same size and revenues and opportunities and challenges that they face, and yet nearly 30 years later, they are in completely different places. How on earth did this happen? Match pair, contrast, what do we learn? In 1976, a charismatic leader named Roy Ash became CEO of Adressograph. A self-described conglomerateur, Ash had previously built Litton by stacking acquisitions together that had since faltered. According to Fortune magazine, he sought to use Adressograph as a platform to reestablish his leadership prowess in the eyes of the world. Ash set forth a vision to dominate the likes of IBM, Xerox, and Kodak in the emerging field of office automation. A bold plan for a company that had previously only dominated the envelope address duplication business. There's nothing wrong with a bold vision. But Ash became so wedded to his quixotic quest that, according to Businessweek, he refused to confront the mounting evidence that his plan was doomed to fail and might take down the rest of the company with it. He insisted on milking cash from profitable arenas, eroding the core business, while throwing money after a gambit that had little chance of success. Later, after Ash was thrown out of office and the company had filed for bankruptcy, from which it did later emerge, he still refused to confront reality, saying, "We lost some battles, but we were winning the war." But Adressograph was not even close to winning the war, and people throughout the company knew it at the time. Yet the truth went unheard until it was too late. In fact, many of Adressograph's key people bailed out of the company, dispirited by their inability to get top management to deal with the facts. Perhaps we should give Mr. Ash some credit for being a visionary who tried to push his company to greater heights. And to be fair, the Adressograph board fired Ash before he had a chance to fully carry out his plans. But the evidence from a slew of respectable articles written at the time suggests that Ash turned a blind eye to any reality inconsistent with his own vision of the world. There is nothing wrong with pursuing a vision for greatness. Indeed, that is what this book is about, pursuing a vision of greatness. After all, the good to great companies also set out to create greatness. But unlike the comparison companies, the good to great companies continually refined the path to greatness with the brutal facts of reality. When you turn over rocks and look at all the squiggly things underneath, you can either put the rock down or you can say, my job is to turn over rocks and look at the squiggly things, even if what you see can scare the hell out of you. That quote from Pitney Bowes executive Fred Perdue could have come from any of the Pitney Bowes executives we interviewed. They all seemed a bit, well, to be blunt, neurotic and compulsive about Pitney's position in the world. This is a culture that is very hostile to complacency, said one executive. We have an itch that what we just accomplished, no matter how great, is never going to be good enough to sustain us, said another. During the key transition years, Pitney's first management meeting of each new year typically consisted of about 15 minutes discussing the previous year, which were almost always superb results, and then 2 hours talking about the scary, squiggly things that might impede future results. Pitney sales meetings were quite different from the aren't we great brah-rah sales conferences typical at most companies. The entire management team would lay itself open to searing questions and challenges from salespeople who dealt directly with customers. The company created a long-standing tradition of forums where people could stand up and tell senior executives what the company was doing wrong, shoving rocks with squiggly things in their faces and saying, look, you'd better pay attention to this. The Adressograph case, especially in contrast to Pitney Bowes, illustrates a vital point. Strong, charismatic leaders like Roy Ash can all too easily become the de facto reality driving a company. Throughout the study, we found comparison companies were the top leader. Comparison companies, these are the ones that didn't become great, were the top leader led with such force or instilled such fear that people worried more about what the leader would say, what the leader would think, what the leader would do, than they worried about external reality and what it could do to the company. Recall the climate at Bank of America, described in the previous chapter, wherein managers would not even make a comment until they knew how the CEO felt. We did not find this pattern at companies like Wells Fargo and Pitney Bowes, particularly during their best transition years, where people were much more worried about the scary, squiggly things than about the feelings of top management. The moment a leader allows himself to become the primary reality people worry about, rather than reality being the primary reality people worry about, you have a recipe for mediocrity, or worse. This is one of the key reasons why less charismatic leaders often produce better long-term results than their more charismatic counterparts. For those of you who are afflicted with a strong charismatic personality, it's worthwhile to consider the idea that your charisma can be as much a liability as an asset. Your strength of personality can sow the seeds of problems when people filter the brutal facts from you. You can overcome the liabilities of charisma. You can transcend this particular affliction. But it does require conscious attention. Winston Churchill understood the liabilities of his strong personality, and he compensated for them beautifully during the Second World War. Churchill, as you know, maintained a bold and unwavering vision that Britain would not just survive, but would prevail as a great nation, despite the whole world wondering not if, but when, Britain would sue for peace. during the darkest days with nearly all of Europe and North Africa under Nazi control? The United States hoping to stay out of the conflict and Hitler fighting a one-front war, he had not yet turned on Russia, Churchill said, "We are resolved to destroy Hitler and every vestige of the Nazi regime. From this, nothing will turn us. Nothing. We will never parley. We will never negotiate with Hitler or any of his gang. We shall fight him by land. We shall fight him by sea. We shall fight him in the air until, with God's help, we have rid the earth of his shadow." Yet despite this bold vision, Churchill never failed to confront the most brutal facts. He feared that his towering charismatic personality might deter bad news from reaching him in its starkest form. So early in the war, he created an entirely separate department outside the normal chain of command, called the Statistical Office, with the principal function of feeding him continuously updated and completely unfiltered the most brutal facts of reality. He relied heavily on this special unit throughout the war, repeatedly asking for facts, just the facts. As the Nazi panzers swept across Europe, Churchill went to bed and slept soundly. "I had no need for cheering dreams," he wrote. "Facts are better than dreams." Now you might be wondering, how do you motivate people with brutal facts? Doesn't motivation flow chiefly from a compelling vision? The answer, surprisingly, is no. Not because vision is unimportant, but because expending energy trying to motivate people is largely a waste of time. One of the dominant themes that runs throughout this book is that if you successfully implement its findings, you will not need to spend time and energy motivating people. If you have the right people on the bus, they will be self-motivated. The real question then becomes, how do you manage in such a way as to not demotivate already motivated people? And one of the single most demotivating actions you can take is to hold out false hopes, soon to be swept away by events. Yes, leadership is about vision, but leadership is equally about creating a climate where the truth is heard and the brutal facts confronted. There's a huge difference between the opportunity to have your say and the opportunity to be heard. The good to great leaders understood this distinction, creating a culture wherein people had a tremendous opportunity to be heard and ultimately for the truth to be heard. How do you create a climate where the truth is heard? We offer four basic practices that we derived from the research. Practice number one. Lead with questions, not answers. In 1973, 1 year after he assumed CEO responsibility from his father, Alan Wurzel's company stood at the brink of bankruptcy, dangerously close to violation of its loan agreements. At the time, the company, then named Ward's, not to be confused with Montgomery Ward, was a hodgepodge of appliance and hi-fi stores with no unifying concept. Over the next 10 years, Wurzel and his team not only turned the company around, but also created the Circuit City concept and laid the foundations for a stunning record of results, beating the market 22 times from its transition date in 1982 to January 1, 2000. When Alan Wurzel started the long traverse from near bankruptcy to these stellar results, he began with a remarkable answer to the question of where to take the company. His answer? "Alan, where are we going to take the company? What's your vision? What's your direction? What's your strategy?" "I don't know." It's such a wonderful answer because it's so honest. Unlike leaders such as Roy Ash of Addressograph, Wurzel resisted the urge to walk in with the answer. Instead, once he put the right people on the bus, he began not with answers, but with questions. Alan was a real spark, said a board member. He had an ability to ask questions that were just marvelous. We had some wonderful debates in the boardroom. It was never just a dog and pony show where you would just listen and then go to lunch. Indeed, Wurzel stands as one of the few CEOs in a large corporation who put more questions to his board members than they put to him. He took the same approach with his executive team, constantly pushing and probing and prodding with questions. Each step along the way, Wurzel would keep asking questions until he had a clear picture of reality and its implications. They used to call me the prosecutor, because I would home in on a question, said Wurzel. You know, like a bulldog. I wouldn't let go until I understood. Why? 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 Like Wurzel, leaders in each of the good to great transitions operated with a somewhat Socratic style. Furthermore, they used questions for one and only one reason. To gain understanding. They didn't use questions as a form of manipulation. Don't you agree with me on that? Or as a way to blame or put down others. Why did you mess that up? When we asked the executives about their management team meetings during the transition era, they said they spent much of the time just trying to understand. The good to great leaders made particularly good use of informal meetings, where they'd meet with groups of managers and employees with no script, agenda, or set of action items to discuss. Instead, they would start with questions like, so what's on your mind? Can you tell me about that? Can you help me understand? What should we be worried about? These non-agenda meetings became a forum where current realities tended to bubble to the surface. Leading from good to great does not mean coming up with the answers. And it does not mean motivating everyone to follow your messianic vision. It means having the humility, level 5 humility, to grasp the fact that you do not yet understand enough to have all the answers. And then to ask the questions that will lead to the best possible insights. Number 2, engage in dialogue and debate, not coercion. In 1965, you could hardly find a company more awful than Nucor. It had only one division that made money. Everything else drained cash. It had no culture to be proud of. It had no consistent direction. It was on the verge of bankruptcy. At the time, Nucor was officially known as the Nuclear Corporation of America, reflecting its orientation to nuclear energy products, including the scintillation probe. Yes, they really named it that. Used for radiation measurement. It had acquired a series of unrelated businesses in such areas as semiconductor supplies, rare earth materials, electrostatic office copiers, and roof choice. At the start of its transformation in 1965, Nucor did not manufacture 1 ounce of steel. Nor did it make a penny of profit. Yet 30 years later, from this disastrous beginning of transformation, Nucor stood as the 4th largest steelmaker in the world, and by 1999 made greater annual profits than any other American steel company. How did Nucor transition from the utterly awful Nuclear Corporation of America into perhaps the best steel company in America? First, Nucor benefited from the emergence of a level 5 leader, Ken Iverson, promoted to CEO from general manager of the joist division. Second, Iverson got the right people on the bus, building a remarkable team of people like Sam Siegel, described by one of his colleagues as the best money manager in the world, a magician, and David Aycock, an operations genius. And then what? Like Alan Wurzel, Ken Iverson dreamed of building a great company, but he refused to begin with the answer for how to get there. Instead, he played the role of Socratic moderator in a series of raging debates. We established an ongoing series of general manager meetings, and my role was more as a mediator, commented Iverson. They were chaos. We would stay there for hours, ironing out the issues until we came to something. At times, the meetings would get so violent that people almost went across the table at each other. People yelled. They waved their arms around and pounded on tables. Faces would get red, and veins bulged out. Iverson's assistant tells of a scene repeated over the years wherein colleagues would march into Iverson's office and yell and scream at each other, but then emerge with a conclusion. Argue and debate, then sell the nuclear business. Argue and debate, then focus on steel joists. Argue and debate, then begin to manufacture their own steel. Argue and debate, then invest in their own mini mill. Argue and debate, then build a second mini mill. And so forth and so on. Nearly all the Nucor executives we spoke with described a climate of debate, wherein the company's strategy evolved through many agonizing arguments and fights. Like Nucor, all the good to great companies had a penchant for intense dialogue. Phrases like loud debate, heated discussions, and healthy conflict peppered the articles and interview transcripts from all the companies. They didn't use discussion as a sham process to let people have their say so that they could buy in to a predetermined decision. This is simply manipulation. The process was more like a heated scientific debate with people engaged in a search for the best answers. Point 3. Conduct autopsies without blame. In 1978, Philip Morris acquired the 7-Up company, only to sell it 8 years later at a loss. The financial loss was relatively small compared to Philip Morris's total assets, but it was a highly visible black eye that consumed thousands of hours of precious management time. In our interviews with the Philip Morris executives, we were struck by how they all brought up the debacle on their own and discussed it openly. Instead of hiding their big, ugly mistake, they seemed to feel an almost therapeutic need to talk about it. In his book, I'm a Lucky Guy, Joe Kullman dedicates 5 pages to dissecting the 7-Up disaster. He doesn't hold back the embarrassing truth about how flawed the decision was. It is a 5-page clinical analysis of the mistake, its implications, and its lessons. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people hours had been spent in autopsies of the 7-Up case. Yet, as much as they talked about this conspicuous failure, no one pointed fingers to single out blame. There is only one exception to this pattern, and that's Joe Kullman himself, standing in front of the mirror, pointing the finger right at himself. It became apparent that this was another Joe Kullman plan that didn't work, Joe Kullman writes. He goes even further, implying that if he'd only listened better to the people who challenged his idea at the time, the disaster might have been averted. He goes out of his way to give credit to those who were right in retrospect, naming those specific individuals who were more prescient than himself. In a modern era, when leaders go to great lengths to preserve the image of their own track record, stepping forth to claim credit about how they were visionary when their colleagues were not, but finding other people to blame when their decisions go awry, it's quite refreshing, I find it refreshing, to come across Joe Kullman. He set the tone. I will take responsibility for this bad decision, but we will all take responsibility for extracting the maximum learning from the tuition that we've paid. When you conduct autopsies without blame, conducting autopsies to figure out what went wrong without any need to put the blame on someone else, you go a long way toward creating a climate where the truth is heard. If you have the right people on the bus, you should almost never need to assign blame, but need only to search for understanding and learning. If you have the right people on the bus, chances are there's a system problem, not a people problem. Point 4. Build red flag mechanisms. We live in an information age when those with more and better information supposedly have an advantage. If you look across the rise and fall of organizations, however, you will rarely find companies stumbling because they lacked information. Bethlehem Steel executives had known for years about the threat of mini-mill companies like Nucor. They paid little attention until they woke up one day to discover large chunks of market share taken away. Upjohn, the comparison company to Abbott, had plenty of information that indicated some of its forthcoming products would fail to deliver anticipated results, or worse, had potentially serious side effects. Yet, it often ignored those problems. With Halcyon, for example, an insider was quoted in Newsweek as saying, "Dismissing safety concerns about Halcyon had become virtual company policy." In another case, when Upjohn found itself under fire, it framed its problems as adverse publicity, rather than confronting the truth of its own shortcomings. Executives at Bank of America had plenty of information about the realities of deregulation. Yet, despite having all the information they could possibly need, they failed to confront the one big implication of those realities. In a deregulated world, banking would be a commodity. And the old perks and genteel traditions of banking would be gone forever. Not until it had lost $1.8 billion did Bank of America fully accept this brutal fact. In contrast, Carl Reichert of Wells Fargo, called the ultimate realist by his predecessor, hit the brutal facts of deregulation smack head on. "Sorry, fellow bankers, but we can preserve the banker class no more. We've got to be businessmen with as much attention to costs and effectiveness as McDonald's." Indeed, we found no evidence that the good to great companies had more or better information than the comparison companies. None. Both sets of companies had virtually identical access to good information. So if that's the case, how do we explain all of this hoopla around information age and information management? The key, it turns out, lies not in better information, but in turning information into information that cannot be ignored. Catch that phrase again. The key lies not in having better information, but in turning information into information that cannot be ignored. One particularly powerful way to accomplish this is through what I like to call red flag mechanisms, or some people have heard me describe it as catalytic mechanisms. Allow me to use a personal example to illustrate the idea. When I was teaching by the case method at Stanford Business School, I issued to each MBA student an 8.5 by 11 bright red sheet of paper with the following instructions. This is your red flag for the quarter. If you raise your hand with your red flag, the world will stop for you. Nothing can prevent you from saying what you have to say. There are no restrictions on when and how to use your red flag. The decision rests entirely in your hands. You can use it to voice an observation, share a personal experience, present an analysis, disagree with the professor, disagree with me, disagree with all your classmates, challenge a CEO guest, respond to a fellow student, ask a question, make a suggestion, whatever. You can do whatever you want with your red flag. There will be no penalty whatsoever for the use of a red flag. Your red flag can be used only once during the quarter, so use it well. But when you use it, no power on earth can take it away from you. Your red flag is non-transferable. You cannot give it or sell to another student. I was a bit nervous using the red flag at first because I had no idea what would happen, especially each day in class. What would somebody do with their red flag? I would lose control over the class discussion for a moment. In one situation, a student flagged me with a red flag and said, "Professor Collins, I think you're doing a particularly ineffective job of running class today. You're leading too much with your questions and stifling our independent thinking. Why don't you let us think for ourselves?" Isn't that wonderful? She was absolutely right. I was doing an ineffective job of Socratic teaching that day, and their learning suffered. Had I not had the red flag and a mechanism for her throwing it in my face, we could have wasted another 40 minutes of 60 people's precious learning time. The red flag confronted me with the brutal fact that my own questioning style stood in the way of people's learning. A student survey at the end of the quarter would have given me that same information, perhaps, but the red flag, in real time, in front of everyone in the classroom, for everybody to see, so I could not possibly ignore it without looking like a complete idiot, turned information about the shortcomings of my class into information that I absolutely could not ignore. I got the idea for the red flag mechanism from Bruce Wolpert, who instituted a particularly powerful device called Short Pay at his company, Granite Rock. Short Pay gives the customer full discretionary power to decide whether and how much to pay on an invoice based upon his or her own subjective evaluation of how he or she feels with the product or service. Short Pay is not a refund policy. The customer does not need to return the product, nor does the customer need to call Granite Rock for permission. The customer simply circles the offending item on the invoice, deducts it from the total, and sends us a check for the balance. Imagine if the airlines did this, right? Imagine if you paid for your trip after your trip, and you circled something, "Well, I wasn't really too happy with the gate agent, so I'm going to take off 40% of the ticket." This would be a catalytic mechanism for the airlines. When I asked Wolpert for his reasons for Short Pay, he said, "You get a lot of information from customer surveys, but there are always ways of explaining away the data. With Short Pay, you absolutely have to pay attention to the data. You often don't know that a customer is upset until you lose that customer entirely. Short Pay is like a early warning system that forces us to adjust quickly, long before we would lose that customer. Short Pay, in other words, takes information and turns it into information that Granite Rock cannot ignore." To be clear, we did not generally find red flag mechanisms as vivid and dramatic as Short Pay in the good to great companies. Nonetheless, I've decided to include the idea here at the urging of research assistant Lane Horning. Horning, who worked on the Good to Great research team and helped me systematically research and collate mechanisms across companies for a different research project, makes a compelling argument that if you're a fully developed level 5 leader, you might not need red flag mechanisms. But if you are not yet a level 5 leader, or if you suffer the liability of charisma, red flag mechanisms give you a practical and useful tool for turning information into information that cannot be ignored, and for creating a climate where the truth is heard. Unwavering faith amid the brutal facts. When Procter & Gamble invaded the paper-based consumer business in the late 1960s, Scott Paper, then the leader and also the comparison company to Kimberly-Clark in this study, simply resigned itself to second place without a fight and began looking for ways to diversify. The company had a meeting for analysts in 1971 that was one of the most depressing I've ever attended, said one analyst. Management essentially threw in the towel and said, we've been had. The once proud company began to look at its competition and say, here's how we stack up against the best, and sigh, oh well, at least there are people in the business worse than we are. Instead of figuring out how to get back on the offensive and win, Scott just tried to protect what it had. Conceding the top end of the market to P&G, Scott hoped that by hiding away in the B category, it would be left alone by the big monster that had invaded its turf. Kimberly-Clark, on the other hand, viewed competing against Procter & Gamble not as a liability, but as an asset. Darwin Smith and his team felt exhilarated by the idea of going up against the best, seeing it as an opportunity to make Kimberly-Clark better and stronger. They also viewed it as a way to stimulate the competitive juices of Kimberly people at all levels. At one internal gathering, Darwin Smith stood up and started his talk by saying, okay, I want everyone to rise in a moment of silence. Everyone looked around, wondering what Darwin was up to. Did someone die? And so, after a moment of confusion, they all stood up, stared at their shoes in reverent silence. After an appropriate pause, Smith looked out at the group and said in a very somber tone, that was a moment of silence for P&G. The place went bananas. Blair White, a director who witnessed the incident, said he had everyone wound up in this thing, all up and down the company, right down to the plant floor. We were taking on Goliath. Later, Wayne Sanders, Smith's successor, described to us the incredible benefit of competing against the best. Could we have a better adversary than P&G? Not a chance. I say that because we respect them so much. They are bigger than we are. They are very talented. They are great at marketing. They beat the hell out of every one of their competitors except one, Kimberly-Clark. And that is one of the things that makes us so proud. Scott Paper and Kimberly-Clark's different reactions to P&G bring us to a vital point. In confronting the brutal facts, the good to great companies left themselves stronger and more resilient, not weaker and dispirited. There's a sense of exhilaration that comes in facing head-on the brutal, hard truths and saying, we will never give up. We will never capitulate. It might take a long time, but we will find a way to prevail. Robert Aders of Kroger summed up this nicely at the end of his interview, describing the psychology of the Kroger team as it faced the daunting 20-year task of methodically turning over the entire Kroger system. There was a certain Churchillian character to what we were doing. We had a very strong will to live, the sense that we are Kroger. Kroger was here before and will be here long after we are gone. And by God, we are going to win this thing. It might take us 100 years, but we will persist for 100 years, if that's what it takes. Throughout our research, we were continually reminded of the hardiness research studies done by the International Committee for the Study of Victimization. These studies looked at people who had suffered serious adversity, cancer patients, prisoners of war, accident victims, and so forth, and survived. They found that people fell generally into three categories. Category one, those who were permanently dispirited by the event. Category two, those who got their life back to normal. And then there's category three, those who used the experience as a defining event that made them stronger. The good to great companies were like those in the third group with the hardiness factor. In the early 1980s, when Fannie Mae began its transition, almost no one gave it high odds for success, much less for great results. Fannie Mae had $56 billion of loans that were losing money. It received about 9% interest on its mortgage portfolio, but had to pay up to 15% on the debt it issued. Multiply that difference times $56 billion, and you get a very large negative number. Furthermore, by charter, Fannie Mae could not diversify outside the mortgage finance business. Most people viewed Fannie Mae as totally beholden to shifts in the direction of interest rates. Rates go up, Fannie Mae loses. They go down, Fannie Mae wins. And many believed that Fannie Mae could succeed only if the government stepped in to clamp down on interest rates. "It's their only hope," said one analyst. But that's not the way David Maxwell and his newly assembled team viewed the situation. They never wavered in their faith, consistently emphasizing in their interviews with us that they never had the goal merely to survive. They had the goal to prevail in the end and to build a great company. Yes, the interest spread was a brutal fact, and it was not going to magically disappear. Maxwell and his team had no choice but to become the best capital markets player in the world at managing mortgage interest risk. Maxwell and his team set out to create a new business model that would depend much less on interest rates, involving the invention of very sophisticated mortgage finance instruments. One analyst said with disdain, "When you've got $56 billion worth of loans in place, and they're underwater, talking about new programs is a joke." That's like Chrysler, which was then asking for federal loan guarantees to stave off bankruptcy, saying it's going to go into the aircraft business. At the end of my interview with David Maxwell, I asked how he and his team dealt with the naysayers during those dark days. "It was never an issue internally," he said. "Of course, we had to stop doing a lot of stupid things, and we had to invent a completely new set of financial devices. But we never entertained the possibility we would fail. We were going to use the calamity as an opportunity to remake Fannie Mae into a great company." During a research team meeting, a team member commented that Fannie Mae reminded her of an old television show. You may have seen this. It's called The $6 Million Man with Lee Majors. The pretext of the series is that an astronaut suffers a serious crash while testing a moon landing craft over the southwestern desert. Now, instead of just trying to save the patient, doctors completely redesign him into a superhuman cyborg, installing atomic-powered robotic devices such as a powerful left eye and these mechanical limbs. Similarly, David Maxwell and his team didn't use the fact that Fannie Mae was bleeding and near death as a pretext to merely restructure the company. They used it as an opportunity to create something much stronger and more powerful. Step by step, day by day, month by month, year by year, the Fannie Mae team rebuilt the entire business model around risk management and reshaped the corporate culture into a high-performance machine that rivaled anything on Wall Street, eventually generating stock returns nearly 8 times the market over 15 years. The Stockdale Paradox. Wherever you are listening to this, if you're driving, if you're walking, if you're at home, wherever, I'd like you to pay special attention to this next section, as it's one that had a huge impact on me. The Stockdale Paradox. Not all the good to great companies faced a dire crisis like Fannie Mae. Fewer than half did. But every good to great company faced significant adversity along the way, of one sort or another. Gillette and the takeover battles, Nucor and imports, Wells Fargo and deregulation, Pitney Bowes losing its monopoly, Abbott Labs and a huge product recall, Kroger and the need to replace nearly 100% of its stores, and so forth. In every case, the management team responded with a powerful psychological duality. On the one hand, they stoically accepted the brutal facts of reality. On the other hand, they maintained an unwavering faith in the end game and a commitment to prevail despite the brutal facts. We came to call this the Stockdale Paradox. The name refers to Admiral Jim Stockdale, who was the highest-ranking United States military officer in the Hanoi Hilton prisoner of war camp during the height of the Vietnam War. tortured over 20 times during his 8-year imprisonment from 1965 to 1973, Stockdale lived out the war without any prisoner's rights. No set release date, and no certainty as to whether he would even survive to see his family again.